This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the last decade, more than 200,000 manufacturing jobs have disappeared in North Carolina. Cheaper labor overseas beckoned. Globalization has come home to North Carolina. The disappearance of those jobs in the last decade marks a sea change in the structure of the state's economy. Those jobs in textile and furniture factories have given way to more temporary jobs in the service sector. Those are jobs that don't pay what the old ones did. And some white-collar workers are finding similar things. What's more, the gap between those earning the lowest wages, the federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour, for instance, and those earning billions at the top, is widening. Some in North Carolina suggest doubling the minimum wage is the answer. Others counter that it could mean fewer jobs for all. And you'll be hearing that today on The State of Things. We're looking at how changes in the global economy have affected jobs, wages, and the poverty rate in North Carolina. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. Should we raise the minimum wage or let the economy sort itself out? Sheldon Danziger joins us from Ann Arbor, where he is professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. He's also author of the book Understanding Poverty. Thanks for joining us today, Sheldon Danziger.
Thank you for having me.
And here in the studio are Sorian Schmidt, who is legislative director of the North Carolina Justice Center. Welcome, Sorian.
Thank you.
And John Hood is president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start with you, Sheldon Danziger, to set us up for where we are in the economy right now, in our place in history. How directly is the poverty rate connected to the economy?
Well, except for the elderly, who have primarily now rely on Social Security benefits that are indexed every year for inflation and don't rise and fall with the business cycle. Working families are very dependent on wages. And in the post-World War II era, wages tended to rise across the board in a period in which the soundbite, a rising tide lifts all boats, became very popular. So for about 25 years following World War II, even though there were ups and downs of the economy, most workers got higher and higher real wages over this quarter century, whether they were less educated workers or more educated workers.
Are we talking here about a middle class, though, that those workers in the middle class especially?
There was a real emergence of the middle class in this post-war II era, particularly unionized manufacturing jobs, the spread of pensions, the spread of vacation days, the spread of health insurance provided by employers. So the real emergence of a homeowning, working middle class appeared. To give you an example, in the late 1960s, all but about 7% of young white male high school graduates earned more than the poverty line for a family of four. And today, the number who are failing to earn that much is four times as high in inflation-adjusted terms as it was in the late 1960s, early 1970s.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about here about the middle class, but our general topic is about poverty here. So, and it almost seems so obvious that poverty might be linked to economic downturns. Right?
Well, that's right. The poor tend to be the last hired and the first fired. And unlike many workers whose wages are subject to union contracts or formal agreements, the minimum wage is only increased by Congress on very periodic occasions. So we haven't had a minimum wage increase since 1997. So just in the last 8 years alone, minimum wage workers have lost ground to other workers.
Do you advocate raising the minimum wage?
I certainly think that raising the minimum wage is one aspect of an effective anti-poverty policy, but there are a lot of other issues relating to the lack of health insurance, relating to the need for subsidized childcare that are important for low-income working families, as well as a minimum wage increase.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if some of this, of the economy we have now, and what you're suggesting there, it's relying on government to do those things, you know, the health care perhaps, and raising, forcing a hike in a minimum wage. And those might have been things that the marketplace took care of right after World War II, where people were paid. They had a higher wage than ever, and those kind of things, their health insurance was taken care of at the job site.
Well, there are pressures on employers everywhere to hold wage costs down because of rapid technological change and rapid globalization, and those factors really didn't emerge until the late 70s, and they've accelerated over the last quarter century. So the poor, in some ways, are losing private employer health insurance. They're losing the ability to have their wages indexed. And so they've come to rely more and more on government at a time when government, for the most part, is less focused on the needs of the poor than was the case in the, say, 1960s and 1970s.
We're talking today in our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, with Sheldon Danziger, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. We welcome your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. With us as well are Sorian Schmidt, who is legislative director for the North Carolina Justice Center, and John Hood, who is president of the John Locke Foundation. And I know you both have differing views on what ought to be done here. I'm going to start with Sorian, because you have advocated doubling the minimum wage, in effect.
Well, we advocate for a strong increase in it, not doubling. I think that you can incrementally increase it. There's a bill entered in the legislature over a three-year period to get it up to $8.50 per hour. And that would go a long way towards making up for some of the inflationary losses in value that minimum wage has experienced. And it also has an impact on people earning hourly wages just above minimum wage as well, which is very positive.
So you're saying that would prompt those wages to go up?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the good thing about that is that then that those people are living on such a shoestring budget that they spend that money immediately, and it generates more economic activity, and it continues or strengthens the economy, and it continues job growth. And so there's a real positive impact, not only for the individual, but for the economy from doing that.
John Hood?
Well, I don't precisely know where to begin. I feel like we're having a discussion in about 1935, and we haven't followed the course of public policy since then. Minimum wages, at least recently, I thought that folks had finally come to the conclusion that raising the minimum wage was a highly ineffective, highly poorly targeted way to address the needs of the poor.
Now, why is that?
Well, most minimum wage workers aren't poor. And if you want to focus public subsidy, which is what a minimum wage is, it's a government mandate that someone be paid more than his or her work is worth. If you want to do that and target the poor, you do it through an earned income tax credit, something where you can actually means test the benefit rather than giving a lot of teenagers who are working their job at the fast food joint extra money on the grounds that it's fighting poverty when they're certainly not poor. So I think the minimum wage raise is a profoundly wrong-headed policy, and it is based on the notion that you can wave a magic wand and make someone's work worth more than it is priced in the marketplace. I would submit you can't do that. If someone's work is actually worth $5.35 an hour or $6 an hour, and you require that employers pay them $8.50, then you're going to have some people get paid $8.50, and you're going to have a lot of other people don't get paid zero because their work is not worth it. And in a competitive marketplace, employers competing for labor, competing for customers, can't pass along those higher costs. They will find automation as a means of delivering the services they need. They will move offshore to find a more appropriate wage level. I just think it's precisely the wrong policy, and I kind of thought we had a consensus across the ideological spectrum about 10 years ago about this, and now it's been decimated.
Mm-hmm. If I could jump in.
Sheldon Danziger, then. Sorry.
Yeah, I think I certainly am a big proponent of the earned income tax credit and think that that's one of the best pieces of social policy we've put into place. But it's a little funny to talk about markets being perfect, et cetera, because if markets were this perfect, then we wouldn't have the really unexplained huge increases in executive compensation, which we've seen in recent years. And there's a lot of popular discussion in the Wall Street press about how high those wages are.
Well, most markets were perfect. It's unfair to mischaracterize my position. I never said markets were perfect.
Most countries have minimum wages. One can clearly raise the minimum wage too high and have a lot of disemployment effects. But there's a lot of good research. Some Princeton economists, Cardin Kruger, a few years ago, studied a minimum wage, I think the minimum wage increase that led to the 4.25 minimum wage. They're relatively modest disemployment effects if the minimum wage is kept relatively modest. So personally, I think raising the minimum wage to $6 or $7 an hour, raising the earned income tax credits, or other ways to do things. Jobs are going overseas anyway. Employers have two ways to go, and people often refer to it as the Costco or Walmart strategy. Both are big successive companies. Both try to keep down prices. There's a notion that if wages are higher, there'll be less employee turnover, and that actually you can increase productivity at the same time you increase minimum wage. So it's not an ideological thing. It's about how to get the balance right. And I think in an economy where for the last 30 years, those at the bottom have fallen behind so that workers today, the bottom 20%, 30%, 40% of workers, not just minimum wage workers, have had great difficulty in this economy.
We're talking with Sheldon Danziger, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan, along with John Hood, president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh, and Sorian Schmidt, legislative director of the North Carolina Justice Center. We're talking about the links between poverty and the economy, what might be done. We're taking your calls as well, 1-877-962-9862. And just ahead, we'll get to those calls and talk more about wages and the rising income gap. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We are talking today about the role of the economy in poverty, how, for instance, globalization and other economic changes affect wages, job security, and the growing income gap in North Carolina as well as in the country. With us are Sheldon Danziger, who's a professor of public policy at the University of Michigan, Sorian Schmidt, legislative director of the North Carolina Justice Center, and John Hood, president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. And we are taking your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. We were discussing the possibility of raising minimum wage to have some impact on the low income for those below the poverty line right now. Sorian Schmidt, you advocate that. John Hood was saying that was not such a hot idea, and you wanted to respond.
Yes. Well, I think that Mr. Danziger is correct that minimum wage is one of several things that need to happen to help low-income workers. And actually, I think John and I are in agreement that there's a major change going on in our economy. What we disagree on is how it's impacting workers. And what we're seeing is that in North Carolina, the jobs that are leaving tend to pay more, about 7% more per year. They tend to offer more benefits, such as health care and pensions, and they offer more leave. And so they're being replaced with these jobs that are temporary, part-time, contractual, offering lower wages, less benefits, less flexibility for child rearing and taking care of other family members. And this is what's really putting North Carolinians in the bind. So the issue is much broader. And I think that when you really look more detail of the jobs coming, you see there's sort of two types, one that pays better but requires more education, and then a lot that pay very little, very close to the minimum wage. And so the minimum wage is geared towards that part, but there's other options available to us to help workers, such as investing in the current workforce to raise their education levels, investing in the future workforce to make sure the kids are getting an adequate vocational or public education that they need. And these kind of things. And they're being discussed, but we're still not fully addressing those issues, and we're sort of sidestepping them.
Well, I wonder if the crux of this might be, you just mentioned, getting the skills. The labor, the jobs are going overseas, and elsewhere overseas because there's a cheaper workforce there that is skilled to do those jobs. And Sheldon Danziger was talking about how after World War II, there was this period, about 25 years in the U.S., that some call an anomaly, in which, you know, with a high school education and no more education than that, you could get a decent job that puts you comfortably in the middle class. You could have your home. And that's tougher and tougher to do now. There's what folks call this hollowing out of the middle class. What's the answer to that, though? I mean, can you get all the skills, you can get all the education and skills you need to get one of those jobs from the old days, but they're not here. They're in, you know, they're overseas in Singapore or Taiwan.
Well, that's not completely true. I think there's part of globalization is a flattening out of accessibility to jobs. In other words, you can plug in your computer, get on the internet, and create a job for yourself potentially. The problem is you got to be educated, you got to have a computer, you got to have internet access. And so, you know, one of the issues is let's get as many of our people ready to compete on that global technology market. On the other hand, we're creating very low-wage service jobs like crazy, and that's happening across the nation, not just here. And we have to deal with the realities that full-time, permanent working adults who want to work as much as possible and support their families are getting tracked into these jobs that can't support them. And how? What are we going to do to help them? Are we going to leave them out there hanging, or are we going to do something such as child care subsidies, health care, you know, help in healthcare to help them?
John Hood, question for you.
All right.
Which would you, if you had your druthers, if you had to choose one, would you take the hike in the minimum wage or that offering of the healthcare and
well,
more
it's
daycare
it's
subsidies?
Not even a choice.
Well,
I
am offering that as a choice.
Well, it isn't really a choice on the merits. You would never take the minimum wage increase. I mean, that's a direct intrusion in the labor market that has almost entirely deleterious consequences. I must say, I mean, this debate about whether the minimum wage, hiking it by a large number would significantly increase unemployment, that's also not a debate. I mean, there are a few atypical examples. That one study that was cited, the Carter-Gruger study from a decade ago, that's been subsequently written about and debunked many, many times. There's actually a pretty wide consensus in the economic literature about the impacts of wage floors and wage ceilings on employment.
But the economy didn't collapse in 1997 when the minimum wage was increased from $4.25 to $5.15, and it wouldn't collapse today if the minimum wage was increased to $6.50, $6.75. It would collapse if the minimum wage was increased to $20, that's for sure. I agree with you on that.
So what would be the exact point at which it would collapse? What's the tipping point? Can you give me that number?
20 would certainly tip it, 6.75 wouldn't.
And your basis is what?
All the research that you're citing. I mean, we can't get into Newmark and Waxer and Carden-Kruger and all that.
I'll be happy to talk about my friend Craig Newmark. He has done excellent work.
Dave Newmark.
Well, the Craig Newmark you ought to look up. There's another point here. There's another point here. When we look at poverty, which is the underlying debate, and we talk about economic trends over the decades, at this point, economics plays a role in perpetuating and generating poverty, but it is not the entire story. It's not even, in my view now, preponderance of the story. Poverty today, chronic long-term poverty, has to do with decisions that are made, unfortunately, when people are quite young, that put them into situations where, in fact, their labor isn't worth enough. They haven't graduated high school. They've dropped out of the workforce. They've had children out of wedlock and been able to build their human capital so that they have valuable work to offer in the market. These are really serious problems. There's a public sector role to addressing it and a private sector role to addressing it. But you can't solve the problems by simply passing laws to pretend that people's labor is worth more than it's actually worth to willing consumers.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. Vernon is with us from Cary. Hi, Vernon.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, welcome. Did you have a question for our guests?
A couple of comments. One, they were talking earlier about, you know, public subsidies to the individual. How come that's unacceptable when we allow public subsidies to companies in the form of price supports, tax incentives, bailouts, protective tariffs, all these sorts of things? And in a comment about the executive compensation, going clear back to the Reagan trickle-down era, executive compensation was not linked to company performance. They would get 20 to 25% increases in an exorbitant package while their employees were seeing less and less increases in their daily, in their annual salary. So I don't see free market here. I see, you know, subsidies and laws and things favoring the companies and the executives, and employees are the ones that bear the brunt.
Oh, well, it's Sorian and then John Hood.
Well, I think the caller's getting at a really fundamental difference with the way that John and I view this, which is that the free economy is not some force of nature. It's created by people. It's influenced by people. There are laws, tax laws, investment laws, banking laws, a huge variety of laws that affect what people are allowed to do and how people are allowed to treat workers. So, for example, in North Carolina, no government can talk to an association representing its workers. They can't work in unison to get a contract. It's illegal. This has an enormous impact on their ability to negotiate for wages. And that means there's a restriction on the free market. You see this throughout the free market. Free market supporters and people putting forward John's view here, I think, frequently like to bring up the free market when they want to stop help for low-income people, but not when they want to regulate abuses by CEOs and corporations to pad the bottom line while ignoring infrastructure and investment. And I just think it really misses the point, and it's a fundamental difference between how we're approaching this.
But I wonder if John Hood's case is that if the minimum wage were to be raised, you had advocated going to $8.50 an hour over a couple of years. And North Carolina can do that. There are states that have a minimum wage higher than the federal one, that there would be these unintended consequences of some places might not be able to hire two people. They'd hire just one. And then that would put somebody who's poor, I mean, not even having a wage,
well,
let alone a living one, but out of work.
Right. The research really doesn't support that. I mean, we've had minimum wage hikes for decades. This has not been a crushing event for the economy. It's not been forcing people out of employment. Again, like I said, people spend the money immediately. These are people who need it. They spend it. And it generates more economic activity. Productivity has been rising through the roof. Employees aren't getting the benefit of that. This is a way of moving some of that down to the lowest wage employees to reward them for increased productivity. I mean, there's a lot of arguments to counter what he's indicating, as Mr. Danziger has also referred to. I just think that to think that where we invest our money as a state is not influencing the market and that the market's this will of nature is just ridiculous. And we need to invest more down with the people who are doing the work.
Right. The smell that you can smell right now is the smell of burning straw men. There been several of them already. I never suggested markets were perfect. They are imperfect. In fact, the reason we have markets is because there's imperfect distribution of information, and markets act as a coordination device for trying to find out what the truth is. No one ever argued it would be preposterous to suggest that minimum wage increases would devastate the economy. The vast majority of workers aren't paid the minimum wage. We're not talking about impacting the overall economy to a large degree. What we're talking about is impacting that relatively small number of people who are eligible for the minimum wage, who are paid the minimum wage, and in fact, in history, over the decades, and I think the evidence on this is overwhelming, that you do in fact have had displacement, particularly of urban youths, of African American youths, of Hispanic youths. When you have minimum wage increases, lots of people benefit from them because they get a higher minimum wage. But disproportionately, people who lose jobs, which is inevitable, are people who are poor, people who are in urban environments, people who don't have a lot of other options. This is just not the right tool for this job.
I mean, and again, I'm going to bring up this number, which I've done over the past few days, because we are talking about poverty, and the federal poverty line is $19,350 a year for a family of four. And presuming there's one person bringing in an income in there, that works out to about $970 an hour over the course of a year. So that is already more than $4 greater than the minimum wage.
True, that's true. And unfortunately, the minimum wage is still $5.15, and it's not even getting people to this federal poverty level. And what we would really put forward, I want to go back to and respond to something. I agree with John that minimum wage isn't the only answer. This affects a relatively smaller portion of the population. The reality, though, is it has a ripple effect to our other hourly wage workers. But I think we are looking at broader investments in the minimum wage. I support the earned income tax credit. I think he's right. It's very targeted. It gets really much more to the heart of the issue here and helps the people who need it the
most.
And
that we should explain, because we've talked about the earned income tax credit. This is a supplement to income. If you're making below a certain income level, and it's not just getting back all your tax that you paid, you're still having to pay your Social Security tax,
Well, no, the Earned Income Tax Credit, in its initial design, it was intended in part to refund not only income taxes, but payroll taxes. That's specifically what it was designed mm-hmm. to do.
Your Social Security tax.
Right, yeah. Yes, your FICA taxes. One could debate how much we should subsidize, take the money from people who earn it, give it to the people who don't. I happen to be very suspicious of welfare in all forms, including, by the way, corporate welfare, as the caller was getting at. But if we're going to subsidize, and to the extent that we subsidize, it makes more sense to do it directly to individuals, as Milton Friedman argued 30, 40 years ago when he made a kind of a version of an earned income tax credit argument, because you can, in fact, ensure that you're not going to be benefiting people who are well above the poverty line, and you aren't going to drive a wedge between what employers are willing to pay, because of the market will bear that, and what you're allowed to pay workers. If you drive that wedge, some people get shafted.
Mm-hmm. But again, the earned income tax credit, just by definition, it's money that comes back at the end of a year to those who make the lowest.
You claim it on your federal income taxes.
Right. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Jerry's in Pittsburgh. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just wanted to appreciate Soren Schmidt's comment a little while ago about how much of this is a policy construction. And at the end of this, this thing I'm going to mention, I want to mention an important bill that's going to intensify the problems if it passes. And it's before Congress right now. But in Europe, I want to make a comparison.
Okay.
In Europe, the kind of economic integration that has been built there has been as deliberate as the U.S.-style economic integration, but it's been in the opposite direction. Now, in Europe, rather than pulling down working conditions and wages and breaking up families by exporting jobs from the richer countries, the European countries have transferred wealth to the poorest countries. They have intentionally raised wages in those poorer countries and improved the working conditions there, even as a condition for letting them into the European community. And right now, even
what is the tax level? What is the tax level there in Europe, though? Is that something that Americans would abide?
Well, no. This is not talking about taxes.
Well, to finance that distribution, it does require a higher tax level, does it not?
No, we're talking about marketplace distortions here. If you have countries that are very poor and are kept poor by rigged elections and all the rest of it and all the international deals, then those people are not getting a fair wage. And if we end up competing with people living under those sad and unfortunate circumstances, then we're not getting a fair deal. But what I want to get to is that we've just suffered through the consequences, well, are suffering through the consequences of the NAFTA agreement, which is a scheme for pulling down. I mean, it results in pulling down working conditions here and pay levels, and now there's an intensification of that that's called the CAFTA that's before Congress right now that, mm-hmm. that could pass.
That's a Central American version of
NAFTA. Central America Free Trade Agreement, and in a recent vote, maybe a year ago, it was fast track for that thing was passed by one vote that came from North Carolina at 3 a.m. So there's a lot of manipulation that goes into these trade agreements and some really unfortunate consequences.
Well, I'd like to put your question, Jerry, to our guests to deal with. John Hood, first of all. Jerry's making the case there that by having these trade agreements mm-hmm. with countries that have workers who work for less, essentially, mm-hmm. if I'm going to boil it down, mm-hmm. that affects the workers here in the U.S. That's
well, I've always thought that was a delightfully ironic argument. What we're essentially suggesting is that people who are clearly poorer than the average poor person in the United States should themselves be shafted. If they can do the work for us at a lower price, which for them would be a wonderful price, we should keep them from doing that. That's the way to fight poverty. No, it's a way to create poverty. It's a way to manage and perpetuate poverty indefinitely.
But don't you want to take care of yours? Isn't one?
But that's what I'm getting at. Isn't
you want to take care of those closer at home?
So in other words, if we have people who are low income in New York, but their income is much higher than people who live in Mississippi, we should always take care of, if we're New Yorkers, we take care of those New Yorkers first, even if they're much better off than the people of Mississippi. I mean, I think this is a very odd and ironic twist to this argument. But generally speaking, countries that wall themselves off from international trade don't fight poverty. They create more poverty. In Europe, if you look at what's going on in Europe, actually, what you find is a stagnant economy in much of the continent and a very fast-growing economy in some places where the labor markets are less regulated, where the taxes are lower. I'm thinking of the Baltic countries. I'm thinking of Ireland, which has been a very successful model in Europe. We would never accept not only the high tax burdens, as you were alluding to, Melinda, but also the high unemployment that exists in France and Germany and all these other states, countries. We would never permit that in the United States.
I'd like Sheldon Danziger to have a chance to answer that. Sheldon?
Well, there are clearly, as I said earlier, there are clearly minimum wages that are too high. There are clearly labor market regulations which are too rigid. A country should try to seek a balance between promoting efficiency, which requires a good deal of free trade. Obviously, if we want other countries to buy Boeing airplanes and Microsoft software and Dell computers, we have to have move toward an equal playing field. So I don't have any problem with free trade. Free trade does create gainers and losers, and a lot of losers in the U.S. have been workers who had good manufacturing jobs who've lost them. I would point to Canada, which has also been through NAFTA, has an economy that looks a lot like ours, has less poverty than we do, because they tax themselves somewhat more, they have somewhat more union-friendly regulation, they have more redistribution through a national health insurance, et cetera. There are no simple answers. But for the last 30 years, we have had a situation where the economy is generating more inequality and more hard times for the low-skilled, and we haven't done anything to offset it.
And we're talking about poverty and the economy in North Carolina with Sheldon Danziger of the University of Michigan, Soyan Schmidt of the North Carolina Justice Center, and John Hood with the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. Just ahead, we'll get to more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862 on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and this hour, as part of our series North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty, we're talking about how the national and global economies affect wages, jobs, and the poverty rate here in North Carolina. We're joined by Soyan Schmidt, Legislative Director of the North Carolina Justice Center, John Hood, who is President of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh, and Sheldon Danziger, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. I want to say that our focus here is on poverty, but a lot of this discussion is talking about, it seems, that hollowing out of the middle class that some have called an anomaly, almost the big middle class that we had in the country after World War II. And that middle class seems the bedrock of so much of the economy. I mean, you think back, Sheldon Danziger, to there in your state of Michigan, you had at one point carmaker Henry Ford saying that he needed to have cars made and priced that his employees could afford. Is there still that? Do you think there's still that mindset here, or folks who need to be cognizant of that anymore, or has the economy changed so drastically from those days?
I think what's happened is that the economy has changed in a way that it's made life more difficult for most people. Many of the people who've stayed in the middle class are doing so because today they're two workers. So take two college graduates who are both high school teachers. They would consider themselves to have good middle-class jobs today, but many of them have difficulty saving to buy a home, sending their kids to private schools or private colleges or whatever. So there's been a lot of economic strain on a lot of workers, and I think that's turned us inward, and we haven't focused very much. Let me give you an example of this change in inequality. I'm looking at a report from the Congressional Budget Office. Between 1979 and 2002, the lowest 20% of families had about $13,000 in 1979 and in 2002. Not much change at all. The next 20% went from about 27,000 to about 30,000, a very small gain in a roughly 25-year period. At the very top, incomes doubled for the 1% of the population from 300,000 to more than 600,000. So there have been a few big gainers. A lot of middle-class families have worked harder to stay in the middle class by having many more working wives today. And over this period, we've become disenchanted with what we think government provides, and we've turned away from the kinds of policies that you see in Canada, Britain, and other market economies that face the same economic changes, but do a better job of protecting workers at the bottom and toward the middle.
Okay. Let's go to Steve in Greensboro. Hi, Steve.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment. I've heard a lot being focused on the offshore manufacturing. My experience has been usually in with companies 40 employees or less, and that's really not the case that I've seen over the last 10 or 15 years. It's more of a case of you have employers, which, for lack of any other word, I would just say out of greed, that they're looking for the lowest cost labor that they can get. And even when they have a very good year, the wealth is pretty much going to them and the items that they want to purchase, not necessarily a bonus program. I agree that you can't keep raising wages to pay someone for a job more than what it's worth. But if the company has a very successful year, there needs to be some way of sharing that profit, you know, more with employees, instead of it just going to one person who doesn't stimulate the economy that much, as opposed to 30 employees would, one individual doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Schmidt?
Yeah, well, I think this really gets at this whole issue regarding the shift of the economy in North Carolina, and what Professor Danziger has said is true in North Carolina, even a little more so. The whole bottom 60% of wage earners in North Carolina have seen very stagnant wages and really sort of lost the gains they made in the 90s during the recession, but not just because it was a recession, but because of this really huge uptick of the globalization of our jobs. And I don't want to say either, I agree with Mr. Danziger and John, that free trade and globalization is not something that's necessarily a bad thing. What I think we're missing is that we are not in looking at how we need to invest in ourselves as a state or as a country to address what that fundamental enormous shift has meant for our economy. And again, I think there's a whole series of things that we could be doing to increase fairness in taxes, to increase fairness in wages, to educate people for the jobs that exist now as opposed to the jobs that we were creating 50 years ago. We're still sort of an industrial focus in our government and our infrastructure. And when we have made,
you know, is that wise to have that focus on industrial if so many of those jobs are going overseas?
No, I think that we're looking at an old framework and we need to update our framework. And when we have done that, such as investing in creating the Research Triangle Park, it has paid off for us. And we could be the cutting edge again, and we could be investing in our people and our infrastructures to compete on this free trade market.
But RTP, though, was not, those jobs attracted people who had more than the high school education. And
that's true. But I think that the point here is that across the board, right now as we sit here, Congress is looking at cutting things that are going to help more people have more than a high school education, that are going to help people who don't have a high school education. And we're not dealing with the fact that the market's changed, the world has changed, and we can no longer act like we're not going to have a lot of low-wage service jobs for the next coming period, or that people can, it's okay that 50% of our students aren't getting a high school degree in 4 years. I mean, we can't just keep pretending that's all right.
John Hood?
Well, let me agree and then disagree. Let me agree that the with both of the other guests that there are really only two ways to increase actual worker wages. And by the way, using wages is probably a mistake. A lot of what's going on with the wage trends is that more compensation is coming in the form of benefits, which is not counted in the wage data. That's one of the many problems that I would have with the use of statistics in the last 10 minutes. But the only two ways we can increase the value of people's work and therefore what they're going to be paid in a market economy is to give them more human capital, more labor skills, education. We need to fight this 40%, essentially a 40% dropout rate in our high schools in North Carolina. We need to do that in a variety of ways. We also need to give workers more physical capital, more stuff, more machinery, technology, which makes their work more valuable. Productivity gains and income gains are fundamentally linked. But let me also say that I just disagree with the entire pessimistic take on the last 25, 30 years of the American economy. We have to be very careful not to use statistics that lead us astray. If we use household data, for example, to look at income trends, we got to remember that during this period, we've had a rather significant increase in divorce. When you take a household of 60,000, you break it up into two households that may now have 30,000 income apiece. You're not changing the amount of money that's flowing.
Or more likely 40-20.
I know, 40-20 it could be.
The men tend to make more.
Right, but there would be some of that would be paid in alimony and child support and so on. But anyway, what you end up doing is creating two households that are obviously lower in income, but the overall wage income of those two people together has not changed. That's not the entire story, but it's some of it. So is immigration. When people immigrate to the United States, to North Carolina, they're usually coming from places that are far worse off economically. If they come to North Carolina and they're showing up in that bottom quintile of the income distribution and pulling the average incomes down, for them it's still a gain. So when we compare households in 1972 with households in 2005, they're not the same households. We have to be very careful not to oversell this point. Most Americans, most North Carolinians do not believe that they're worse off than the past generation, that the next generation's going to be worse off, and I think they're right.
1-877-962-9862. John Hood, you touched on the issue of immigration, and I want to talk about one subset of that, and that is illegal immigration. And what about the impact on wages of having a workforce in the state, 300,000 illegal immigrants by the last estimate, of having that pool of workers who can be exploited and paid less than the existing minimum wage? What effect, Sorian Schmidt, is that having on tamping down wages? Because if an employer can go out and say, well, I can just hire this group of guys here and not have to worry about benefits, anything else, mm-hmm. why would that employer want to bother paying the minimum wage or even $8 an hour?
Well,
to somebody who
first
is
I would say these
immigrant.
People aren't illegal. They're undocumented or their documentation is run out at some mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. They may have come here illegally, but they have a problem. And I think that there's sort of two parts to this. One, clearly with the large growth of Latinos coming into our state, which are the majority of our immigrants, they are working a lot, and they probably are having some depressing impact on low-wage jobs. On the other hand, the shifts that we're talking about, the move from manufacturing, for example, to service work, had already occurred before their migration began. In 1991, we had made the shift from there being more manufacturing than anything to now there being more service work than anything that paid less and offered fewer benefits and less permanence. And so the trends in the shift in the job market are so much greater at this point than the impact that migrant workers are having, whether they're here documented or undocumented, that I think that their impact is very minimal. I don't want to say that it doesn't exist. There probably is some depression at the lowest wage jobs because of that. I think the biggest thing that it creates is that they're incredibly vulnerable to being abused by the small group of unscrupulous businesses that are taking advantage of them, and they can't fight back.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, Sheldon Danziger, can you give us any historic perspective on has something like that? Is that happening here in the U.S., in North Carolina? Is there a precedent for that type of thing in the history of economics in the U.S.?
Well, we certainly had a huge influx of immigration from Europe at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. So it's precedented in historical perspective, and there were very similar kinds of discussions about the effect of immigrants taking jobs away from native-born workers. I don't know the situation in North Carolina. What I'd point out is something that was just mentioned, that many of these changes have gone on in areas with immigration and also those with very little immigration. So you see the same kind of change from a manufacturing to a service job in Michigan, which has not had the kind of immigration that you've had in North Carolina. So there are a number of studies. It's clear that in some labor markets, immigrants do take some jobs from native workers. It also
I did want to be clear. I was not talking about all immigrants because we are a nation of them. I was talking about that subset of illegal immigrants.
Well, I think there were plenty. Workers. There were plenty of undocumented workers in the 19th century as well.
Yeah.
But one of the things that John said about certainly getting one way to get workers more productive is to get them better equipment, and having a higher minimum wage is one of the ways that employers can be encouraged to adopt some technological changes. And if you have a rigorous enforcement of employment laws, then employers that are not effectively screening workers are not going to be able to hire people without documentation.
Okay, we go to Jesse in Chapel Hill. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I'm coming from a little bit different direction here on as a technology worker, as a computer science graduate, and having watched an overflow of offshore jobs onto the market. When I hear that the education system, and we're supposed to educate our kids more and have them go more into the sciences and stuff, I've found my industry to be literally devastated in this particular area. And so I counsel my children on what it is that they should, why they should go and get, we're talking $12 and $13 an hour jobs in technology because of, a just infinite supply of offshore labor with also governments investing in training offshore labor to replace our jobs. I wanted to basically ask the panelists what their insights on that are as far as what you're looking toward as being a technology.
It's not just a blue-collar issue. It's a white-collar issue. John Hood? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. We saw in North Carolina there are actually blue-collar jobs associated with technology that don't get as much attention in this part of the state, but in the Hickory, Lenore, Catawba Valley area where the unemployment rate just before the recession was about 2%, they had a serious labor shortage problem. That unemployment rate in some of those counties went over 10% within the course of 18 to 24 months. That was the fiber optic industry going south. There is no guarantee if you bet on a particular industry, be it biotech or information tech or anything else, that 5 or 10 years later you aren't going to find a very different situation. This is why we need to not get into the business of attempting to guess which industries are going to succeed or fail, and investing in industries, bad idea. But another point I would make is that we ought not to mistake or equate education with labor skills. It's not that they are not the same thing. Much of the valuable labor skills that people develop are on the job. So when we focus on it, we've just got to get more people going to college, more people going to training programs. Okay, but don't oversell that point either. Much of the valuable skills that people develop is on the job as they're learning a new skill.
I'm going to give Sorian just a couple seconds before we have to go.
Well, I think that the caller's right. This is affecting a wide variety of people, and that's part of this change we need to make. We need to make our people more portable so they can transfer their skills easier. That means they need to be able to take health benefits with them. They may need wage insurance for when their job suddenly shows up in India and they're in the process of shifting. You know, they've got to get more flexibility. We've got to build into the system. There are answers. They got to start happening at the federal and the state level.
Okay. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. Sorian Schmidt is Legislative Director of the North Carolina Justice Center. John Hood is President of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. And Sheldon Danziger is Professor of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and author of the book Understanding Poverty. Thank you all for being with us today to talk about this. And that is the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment that we couldn't get on the air right away, well, you have another opportunity. We have a hotline for North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty. That number is 1-877-3-VOICES. That's 1-877-3-VOICES. We'd love to hear what you have to say. You can, of course, drop us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Doug and Peggy Abrams, the Julian Price Family Foundation, Maupin Taylor, PA, the Michael and Laura Brader Arahe Foundation, and the North Carolina Humanities Council. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.